Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, May 8th. You know, things change dramatically, and things remain the same in the coronavirus era. Things are changing when more than 20 million Americans last month lost their jobs. That's the new government stat. More than 20 million Americans lost their jobs in April. The previous one-month record was 2 million. And that was in 1945. Things are changing when, as the world waits for a new vaccine, parts of Africa have suspended use of an old one for polio as part of coronavirus emergency response. Things are changing when the value of Iran's currency has plummeted so much with the crashing oil prices, since people aren't flying or driving, plus from U.S. sanctions, that the government there has decided to lop off three zeros from the way the currency is numbered. I guess if we were paying $20,000 for a pizza instead of $20, we might lop off three zeros too. Things are changing when countries have to choose among degrees of locking down their economies. Spain and Wuhan, intense. The United States, middling and conflicted. Sweden, less than any affected country. How's that working out? We'll take a look in a minute. But some things remain the same. Brooklyn prosecutors say of the 40 people arrested for social distancing violations in the borough, 35 of those 40 have been black. And because another unarmed black man was shot to death in Georgia by a couple of white guys, they've even been charged with murder in this case. And despite the video of it played over and over again on cable news, and we know who watches cable news all day, the President of the United States had nothing to say about it yesterday when asked. With me now, Ian Bremmer, Columbia University International Affairs Professor, Time Magazine Global Affairs columnist, host of the G-Zero World on PBS and G-Zero Media, and president of the Eurasia Group, which does consulting on political risks to the economy. Somewhere in his life, I suppose he sleeps. Thanks for coming on today, Ian. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, such a pleasure to be back with you.
So let me start with Sweden, because you wrote a New York Times op-ed called Sweden's Coronavirus Myth, a seductive example that the United States should not follow. Can you describe first what Sweden's approach actually is for people who haven't heard about this?
Yeah, it's not cats and dogs sleeping together. It is a healthcare-driven approach where people are told relentlessly to socially distance, to wash their hands, to wear masks, but it's not mandatory. And the level of mandatory lockdown is very limited. So a lot of schools were shut. Couldn't have gatherings of more than 50 people, but, you know, parks open, restaurants, bars open. And so as a consequence, felt a lot less harsh in terms of what the government actually mandated than what we've seen in pretty much any other major developed economy. That was what the Swedish approach has been.
It's been called in, you know, in short, in shorthand, herd immunity. Can you define that term? Because people are taking this as Sweden's not really locking down their economy. They're just letting people play Russian roulette with their lives, hoping enough people get the virus, but enough people survive the virus that it'll be okay.
Well, it is true, Brian, that a lot more people are getting coronavirus and dying from it in Sweden than any of the other Nordic countries. And so there's some truth to the fact that this is pretty dangerous stuff. At the same time, the Swedish approach has not helped on the economy. It is expected to contract by 6.8% by the IMF in 2020, which is actually slightly more than the other Scandinavian countries. So the only benefit would come would be if you actually do get herd immunity over time. And the idea behind herd immunity is that something between 60 and 80% of the population has been infected, they have antibodies, and therefore the country is effectively immune. You've beaten it. Even without a vaccine, you can all go out. Now, here's a very big problem. First is they're very far from those numbers. Only about 20 to 23% of Swedes in Stockholm, the capital, have antibodies for coronavirus so far, and much less than that in the rest of the country. So they're nowhere close to herd immunity. Secondly, the doctors don't agree on whether antibodies would be suitable if you just got the disease but didn't have many symptoms, or do you have to actually have serious symptoms for the antibodies to protect you going forward, and for how long? We don't actually know. And so there's a lot of what if that you're relying on in Sweden to make this actually work. But the big point is that even if all of that stuff is true and it works out really well, and no one would bet on that right now, you still couldn't apply it to the United States because our country is so damn different. We have a federal approach. It's local governors doing what they want. So it couldn't be a national approach. We have nowhere near the healthcare system, nowhere near the level of belief and support for our government that we'd all follow the rules. And our pre-existing health conditions are so much worse than in Sweden: hypertension, obesity, diabetes, you name it. So, I mean, there's no way that this would be an appropriate response in the United States.
And yet we have the former governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, saying, hey, we just have to accept that more people are going to die so we can reopen our economy. And the lieutenant governor of Texas saying basically the same thing. And since he's older, that lieutenant governor, Patrick, says, if it means I'm going to put my life at risk so that we can have life as usual in the United States, I'm volunteering. So for you as an economy watcher, more than a public health watcher, what do you think about the ways that some U.S. states are reopening, even as their case numbers are going up?
I think it's right that there are real trade-offs. And for the first couple of months of this pandemic, I was most concerned that right here in our own beloved New York City, we were going to have a Northern Italy type experience where there would be so many people getting seriously sick. We'd overwhelm the healthcare system. There wouldn't be enough ventilators. There wouldn't be enough PPE. Our healthcare workers would themselves get sick and die, and mortality rates would be 10 times higher than they presently are in New York. That was my concern. And we locked down late. We got our testing and our healthcare late, but we didn't overwhelm the healthcare system in New York, and we're not across the United States. So that's a really big hurdle that we got through. And I think it was wholly appropriate to focus overwhelmingly on healthcare and not much on the economy when we were facing that. Now that we know that the healthcare system will stand up, and we also know that we're at least a year away from a vaccine at scale, it is appropriate for us to start talking about the real trade-offs between an economic depression with 20%+ of the population not able to work for extended periods of time, and the costs of that, the human costs, the economic costs, I mean, all across the social costs, and how many people will be exposed and die and get really sick if we open and loosen the economy early. And I think the appropriate response, what we saw from the CDC, which the Trump administration announced a few weeks ago, here are the parameters by which you should be thinking about opening your economy. And the first phase is after you have sufficient testing and 14 days of caseload going down. I thought that was appropriate, Brian, but here we are a couple weeks later and a bunch of states across the country are opening and they haven't actually hit the Trump administration's own suggested guidelines. That I think is a problem. I think we need much more coordination and we need much more authority around how we deal with this crisis. As a consequence, I suspect we are much more vulnerable to a lot of expansive second waves And New York City's done a really good job, the metro area, New Jersey and Connecticut, but the rest of the country is nowhere close to flattening the curve. And some of those are, you know, relatively small numbers of cases. They've got more flexibility. But when you're looking at a lot of the Deep South, you're looking at Texas, you're looking at some other major states, I think we're going to get ourselves in trouble here.
And cycling back to Sweden, which you wrote about in your New York Times op-ed and which we started the conversation with, you write that as they take their chances with people's lives by keeping their economy more aggressively open than other countries, you write that in a certain way, Sweden is the future. So what did you mean by that?
Well, that we're all going to be heading into that situation. Remember, Sweden is earlier than the United States, the Europeans in general, a couple weeks ahead of what we've experienced. So we're looking to the Swedish experiment to see what happens when you have a bunch of states in the United States that have much worse underlying conditions, much less authority of their local officials, and they start opening their economy. What's going to happen as a consequence of that? I think that's going to be really interesting. Germany taking a much, much more cautious approach, and the lockdown is being opened very incrementally. Remember, when we shut down our economies, it was with a sledgehammer. I mean, overwhelmingly, all around the world, you had all these governments saying, we're shutting it down. Opening the economy takes a lot longer. And it's not just what the government says. It's also, can the businesses reopen? I mean, do the parents, do they have access to childcare? Can they get on public transport? Is it safe for them to do so? Can the company actually open with social distancing and the costs that are going to be required to that and the hit to profitability? And then what about the consumers who aren't going to be consuming as much? So there are a whole bunch of things that are required to happen before economies can truly reopen. And decisions being made by governments are only a small one of all of those steps.
So, Ian, let me touch on some of the other stories that I mentioned at the top, things you've been following and flagging on your Twitter feed. What's this about polio vaccines suspended in some countries?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you're talking about is all sorts of challenges with coronavirus. Overwhelmingly, you're putting the doctors on that. You're putting your funding on that. The Gates Foundation, which has done more than any other organization in the world for global health over the past 10 years, has said that they are devoting all of their resources to fighting coronavirus going forward. That's fantastic news for us for a vaccine and for coronavirus. But what about dealing with malaria? What about dealing with polio? Not as much of a priority. So, yeah, you're going to see all sorts of secondary health problems that come as a consequence of just how much resource has to go towards coronavirus. You've already heard about all of these people that don't go to the hospital because they're concerned about their own ailments, things like heart attacks, things like strokes, and have died from those things because they don't want to expose themselves or they're worried that they're not going to be able to be taken care of adequately. They come in late. And as a consequence, their maladies are much worse. In the developing world, and particularly the poorest countries that already have the least capacity to respond to something like coronavirus, this becomes a bigger problem.
We have a call with a connection to Sweden, just as we were hoping for. Jerry in Cedar Knolls, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, good morning, Brian. I am in fact Swedish. I moved here when I was 11, so most of my family is still over there. And speaking to them about the Swedish approach compared to the American approach, it's very interesting. As you may know, Swedes are very pragmatic people, and no one is really panicking or feeling like the Swedish government is doing a disservice by this approach. I was surprised to hear about the projections about the Swedish economy contracting in a similar manner or more than their neighbors. That was actually the only surprising thing that I've heard on the show so far today.
And what are you hearing from people who are still in Sweden, since you're from there originally, about how controversial their approach is?
So my father is actually 67 years old. I have my grandparents who are in their 80s and 90s. So paying particular attention to those folks who are in the risk groups, they are essentially taking advantage of many of the things that we have here. They have special hours set aside for people to go get their shopping done, and being able to have more social distancing over there. My younger cousins and so forth over there, they're just happy that they're still able to get to work, and that there, you know, hasn't been the massive layoffs that they have over here.
And about people dying? It doesn't sound like from your description that it's so controversial. Are they losing a lot of older people?
No, again, so as I said, people take a more pragmatic approach. They're less prone to panic. We have less left-wing, right-wing type voices over there, not to say that they don't exist. But no, people don't get nearly as riled up as you might expect them to over the fact that folks are dying.
Jerry, thank you very much. A very interesting cross-cultural view. Erica in Plainview on Long Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Brian. Long-term listener and third-time caller, I think. Third time I've gotten through to you. And thank you for all of your reporting and work during this difficult time. I have connections to Israel through friends that have moved there over the years and so forth in my time there. And Israel took its social distancing and self-quarantining very, very seriously. It was really enforced by the military, and people that had traveled abroad were expected to come back and self-quarantine for 2 weeks. That was enforced, like security would come and knock and make sure that that person was self-quarantine and following the rules. And
They did that. They would check up. Maybe that's what we're headed for next year in New York. I don't know.
Yeah, it was checked up on, Israel obviously is a much smaller country. And such things may be a little easier in some ways. But they checked up, they knocked on doors. Geographically,
the size of New Jersey, for people who don't know. But anyway,
geographically, that's what you learn in Hebrew school. That's right. So as a result, they're able to start opening up. So children went back to school on Sunday last week. The school week in Israel starts on Sunday. They started with the elementary schools. They started going back in some sort of modified way with a modified schedule. A friend of mine posted herself getting a haircut with masks on. The hairstylist was wearing a mask and gloves, but she was getting a haircut. Another friend of mine posted himself sort of out walking in Tel Aviv. No one had masks on, and they're starting to reopen the country slowly but surely. So, that's just another story where the social distancing, it was really enforced and taken very, very seriously. And therefore
effective. Yeah.
Exactly. Very
Erica,
effective.
Thank you so much. Very instructive. I really appreciate it. Be a fourth time caller sometime. And Ian, I'm going to take one more because it's not every day that we get a call in from Bologna, Italy, but we are getting one right now. So Elizabeth in Bologna, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, good morning. I'm a native New Yorker. I've lived in Bologna for over 20 years. We got slammed. It's the north of Italy, so in the beginning, the lockdown was very serious. I got stopped even if I took out the garbage, anything. Now we've entered, May 4th, we entered phase two. We can take a walk. We can go in the piazza. The kids can't see their friends yet. But the thing I noticed even today I had a hospital visit and I was looking down the street, and the small things that seem to be such a big deal in the States, for us, it's just common sense, and it's just respect for your neighbor to wear a mask. Nothing is political here. It just, the prime minister asked us to do these things. And in fact, my kids are like, God, the Italians are making such a good impression, because it's the first time that Italians are not famous for following the rules. But this time we all follow the rules.
They stop you when you take out the garbage?
Oh, they're very polite, but they say, good afternoon, where are you going? Going to take out the garbage. Okay, go home now. They stop, I'm divorced. My ex-husband lives about 10 blocks away. Stop my kids all the time when they go back and forth. They have to have a permission slip. And one time they stopped my one son and they said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to see my father. And they said, well, where does your mother live? He said, right there. He goes, well, go back to your mother. He says, well, I need to see my father. He goes, oh, cry me a river. I'd like to see my father, too, but you can't.
Wow. Elizabeth, thank you so much. So what do you think when you hear the news from New York, where you're originally from, and the lockdown is you can still go out and, you know, just wear a mask and socially distance 6 feet. You can go running, bicycling. The parks are open, just socially distance six feet.
I just think you're never going to catch up. I'm like, it doesn't work. We tried it that way in the beginning, but the parks were like yours. I think one of the doctors in the hospital saw the parks, and he was like, no. And he just went on YouTube and said, look, we're talking about saving our nation. I don't want to be overdramatic, but you can't do it. Because people take advantage. Suddenly everybody's sporty. Everybody's a bike rider. And so they just locked it all down.
Elizabeth,
we
thank you so much.
We tried to do it that way.
Stay safe over there.
You're
thank
welcome.
You so
thank
much.
Thank you so much. I listen to the show every day. It's a different
thank
hour
you.
Here, so I plan from 4 to 6 to listen every day.
I don't think of myself as accompanying people's afternoon commutes, but I guess when you live in Bologna, Italy, I do. Thank you so much. We so appreciate it, and I'm so grateful that you're still interested in the show. So, Ian Bremmer, what do you think? Such interesting stories, and at least the last two from Israel and Italy had to do with much more enforcement of social distancing than we've seen here yet.
Let's just be proud of ourselves for a second. I mean, live in New York City.
Unfortunately, your line is breaking up really, really badly. So, you know what? Let's try one more time. And since I was going to ask you next anyway about what you pointed out today regarding Iran, with them lopping 3 zeros off their currency, having somewhat to do with oil price shocks from the coronavirus era. We have a caller who has ties to Iran, Bijan in Newark. Bijan, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Bremmer. I hope you can still hear. I don't know if you heard the news, but last night around 1 o'clock in the morning Iran time, they actually had a massive earthquake just outside Tehran. So it's been kind of one thing after another. And the question I have for Mr. Bremmer, and I would just kind of pose, I guess, to the audience is, if you look at the last 6 or 8 months, you know, in Iran, it was kind of like one crisis after another. And then COVID, I can tell you from talking to my family and friends over there, whatever is being reported, you know, multiply it times 10,000. The situation is really bad. They also tried to reopen right around the Iranian New Year, which takes place in spring. And a big part of it is kind of what we're seeing here, where politicians are trying to placate the public and say things like things aren't so bad, but they were digging, you know, mass graves outside of Qom, one of the major cities there. And so I guess the question I'd like to ask Mr. Bremmer, if he's able to get back on the line, is with these authoritarian regimes, how much more can they take? You know, there's the economic crisis, military crisis, and now with COVID, and now, you know, earthquake and floods, you know, who knows what's coming next? At what point will you start to see populations kind of hit the breaking point? Same kind of thing that we're seeing here as well. When you hear politicians or other pundits say, you know, everybody can get a test, you can hear it, but at some point you kind of look out the window and say, well, that doesn't make sense. And in Iran, that's kind of the playbook because they control a lot of the media. At some point you're saying, well, listen, you keep telling me things aren't that bad, but I just drove down the street and there's these tents outside hospitals. And, you know, I talked to my cousin and, you know, 4, 5, 6 family members are dying, you know? So, that's the question. It's a really difficult situation over there right now.
Ian, wow. Were you able to hear Bijan's question?
Yeah. And hopefully this is a much better line. I think the thing to pay attention to, and it's a connection with all of the callers, really, is that this crisis, which started in China, then moved to Europe and the United States, is now moving to the developing world. There are now more cases in the developing world than in the developed world on a day-to-day basis, and they are massively under testing, which means in reality, it's far, far greater on them. And the impact of coronavirus is going to be much longer and much greater economically than it has been on the pandemic / healthcare side. So Iran can handle 3 months, 6 months if they need to have crackdowns, but we're talking about 2-3 years minimum of some of the poorest countries in the world, Philippines, they're so reliant on remittances from people traveling all over the world, but they can't travel anymore. So what's happening to that 10% of their GDP? It goes away. Globalization takes a massive hit from 2-3 years of lockdown. And the United States, at least we have the money. We can indebt ourselves more, but we can keep these people afloat. It's just about political will. It's just about our government willing to write those checks to ensure that people that are unemployed can still make it over 6 months, over 12 months. In a country like Iran, in a country like Ecuador, in sub-Saharan Africa, they don't have that capacity. And the IMF isn't going to be there enough to bail them out. That's where the crisis is really going to hit, not 2020 with our 15% unemployment, but 2021 in developing world and billions of people all over the world that just aren't going to have the capacity to dig themselves out of something that really is, when we look back on it, this isn't a recession. It's going to be a global depression and the only one in our lifetimes.
We're going to have to leave it there. I think we've learned a lot from you, Ian, and from our amazing callers. You know, I feel so honored every single day to be able to do a show like this in New York City, where people from all over the world live, so that, you know, just for diversity for its own sake, for the wonderfulness of having people from everywhere just to interact with, even though at the moment I have to stay home mostly, you know, then when it comes to something like this, information exchange, global views taken country by country by country, advice, different perspectives that enlighten everybody else's perspectives. We're just so lucky to be able to do the show in New York with everybody who lives here. Ian, just, you want to tell people what's coming up on your podcast?
Yeah, sure. We've got former Governor Vilsack and former head of Secretary of Agriculture talking about one of the next things that's going to hit, which is the disruption in global supply chain on food, particularly meat. So that's worth paying attention to.
That podcast is G-Zero World with Ian Bremmer. Ian is also president and founder of the political risk consulting firm Eurasia Group and G-Zero Media. Thanks as always. We'll have you back, of course.
Talk to you soon, Brad. Be good.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.